Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
House music from the federal government.
Attention first-time home buyers. There is currently a tax credit up to $8,000 available to you if you purchase a home before December 1st, 2009.
The federal tax credit for home buyers could keep home sales afloat, but last month the numbers dropped. Is the cautious optimism over?
Over? Did you say over? Nothing is over until we decide it is.
Animal houses and new home sales, a serious look on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 25th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry.
Good morning, Celeste. After a vigorous discussion of the housing situation, we're going to talk about how the fix is in on the banks. Democrat Barney Frank is hunting bad bank fees with some high-powered regulations. Todd Zwillick will tell us if Senator Max Baucus has balked in the latest episode of Healthcare in the Finance Committee. And our Friday movie gang has trivia and will help you pick a flick this weekend.
But first, Nicholas Retsinas joins me. Nicholas is the director for the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Nicholas, after 4 months of steady gains in national home sales. Home sales were down last month. Aren't home sales supposed to be on the way up right now? What do these new numbers mean?
Well, a lot of people thought they were on an upward trajectory given the results of the last 3 or 4 months. But a couple things. One, monthly numbers are volatile, so it's hard to overstate the import of one number. But secondly, there are still storm clouds. We still have foreclosures. We still have people losing jobs. And all of that is certainly going to delay any long-term housing recovery.
Okay, so Nicholas, stay with us. We're going to talk more about that later. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
And in the headlines, Iran has told the United Nations it has a second nuclear enrichment plant. Our partner, the New York Times, reports President Obama and other world leaders will demand that Iran open that facility up to United Nations inspectors. The president holds a news conference this hour from the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, and we'll let you know what he says about Iran and everything else. The Justice Department is working to have a Colorado man charged in a bomb plot moved to New York for court. Investigators say he purchased common chemicals from beauty supply stores. They say he had notes on how to turn those goods into explosives.
More protests expected outside the G20 today. Yesterday, riot police fired pepper spray and made arrests when some of the rowdier demonstrators refused orders to break up. And Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wakes up in a hospital this morning. She became lightheaded yesterday after treatment for an iron deficiency. Earlier this year, she had pancreatic cancer surgery.
Overseas, five more American troops are dead after attacks in southern Afghanistan, and Charles Manson follower Susan Atkins is dead of brain cancer at 61. She died in a prison hospital, confessed to killing actress Sharon Tate 40 years ago. The futures markets are settling on a positive opening on Wall Street when trading gets underway about an hour and a half from now. Wall Street dipped a bit yesterday, though. The Dow opens at 97.07. The S&P starts trading at 10.51. The NASDAQ begins at 21.08. After 4 months of gains, as Celeste said, national sales were down last month. Tell us what's going on in your neighborhood regarding housing.
Oh, from Detroit, the reason why there are so many vacant homes is because of the crime. So people don't want their kids going to school there. It's not really good right now.
Go outside, look around your neighborhood. How many signs are you seeing? Foreclosed homes, boarded up homes, for sale signs? Are there no for sale signs on your block? Call us at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. A discussion of housing coming up.
Nothing is over until we decide it is.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. We have a really interesting show this morning. First of all, we're going to be following all morning the details that are emerging on those terror suspects and those terror investigations that are taking place. The arrests, you'll recall, earlier this week in Denver and New York. But first, we're serious about getting data points on the confusing issue of where is the housing market right now?
Hi, my name is Carla Wynn, and I'm calling as a listener on WEAA. I live in the Carroll Hilton neighborhood of Baltimore City. And although my street has only two blocks and there are no for sale signs or foreclosure signs around the corner on Hilton Street, on Rosedale Street, there are about five or six for sale signs, one auction sign, and about 10 to 12 houses that are boarded up.
Thanks for that, Carla. We are looking for data points all around America on housing. Go outside, take a look at what's literally going on your block. And Nicholas Retsinas, a professor and director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University, we're putting together some data points for you. Are you listening carefully?
Yes, I am.
All right, we're going to get some people on here who are eyewitnesses of various parts of the housing industry, and I'm going to come back to you and see if a picture is starting to come into focus as we move through the conversation, okay?
Of course.
All right. And, of course, we want you to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. We begin with Ken Ebaugh, who's a senior mortgage banker with Paramount. He's on the line from Detroit, Michigan. You are an eyewitness to the question of whether credit availability is beginning to loosen up and enable people to buy homes. What are you seeing, Ken?
Good morning. I see it's a great time and a very exciting time to be a first-time home buyer. Credit itself has been about the same for the last six to 12 months, and people are getting into the game a little bit more right now to try to take advantage of the first-time home buyer tax credit.
And again, that's going to run out in December, and there was talk by the Federal Reserve that maybe they would end that early. How significant is that first-time home buyer tax credit in your business?
Very significant. I think it's pulling people off the fence who were sitting there as either renters or people looking to get into the market, and now they realize that November 30th is looming, and that is the drop-dead date right now to take advantage of the first-time home buyer credit and actually purchase a home by that date to take advantage of the credit.
All right, Ken, I want you to sit there and count on your fingers, and I'll come back to you in a second, the number of people who've come off the fence because of that first-time home buyer tax credit. We'll come back to you and get a hard number, all right? Behrouz Shahidi is a real estate agent in New Jersey, and he's been on the program before. Behrouz, you are an eyewitness to the actual retail end here. Are you seeing more people looking for homes and actually going to contract?
Good morning. Yes, there are many more people that are looking, and are they actually going to contract? That's a different question.
So you're seeing a buzz, but not necessarily the transactions that are actually making the money change hands.
Yep.
All right. Eric Mattinson is a banker from Greensboro and owner of a new home. He bought the home in August, and you are a first-time home buyer, Eric. Is that true?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
So you can check $8,000 coming to me on your tax return next year, right?
I don't know if it's coming to you, but I'm looking forward to it.
Now, Ken Ebaugh just a moment ago said that the tax credit pulled people off the fence and brought them into the market. Is that the case with you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So you wouldn't have done it. You would not have done it without that $8,000 tax credit.
I mean, there was one other factor that led to it, and that was our neighborhood we were currently in was going to get bulldozed by eminent domain.
Well, that'll cause you to move. Yeah.
I mean, you know, but we wouldn't necessarily have bought a house. You know, my wife's a stay-at-home mom, and so it had to be the right time. And you know, the market also helped that there was a depressed market in the economy and so forth. So, but we really needed that in order to be able to purchase a home that we wanted and the size that we wanted and be able to fix it up the way we wanted.
Right. All right, Eric, I'm going to give you a little homework, too, like I gave Ken Ebaugh. I want you to sit and think about the number, and it could be a price number, it could be an interest rate number, it could be a monthly payment number that gets you into the market. What was it? I'm going to come back and ask you. And, Behrouz, some homework for you as well. How many customers going to contract represents a turnaround for you? Sit and think about that number, and I want to talk to Nicholas Retsinas here for a moment. So there's an interesting picture. You've got houses for sale in Baltimore and foreclosure signs and a dozen houses that are boarded up. You've got Ken Ebaugh saying it's a great time, but things are only happening a little bit. Behrouz sounds a little depressed out there. And Eric is a first-time home buyer.
Well, it's certainly information is mixed as the data is mixed. I think the picture that you've painted, and it's a pretty good picture, are people on the sidelines, teetering of whether to buy or not. For those who are not first-time home buyers and who don't get the credit, there's still a little worry. Has the market reached the bottom? Is this the good time to buy? For first-time home buyers, sure, the government's giving me money. It's an incentive. If I'm at the border, if this works for me, if the numbers work for me. But I still think there is this skittishness in the general market. People just not quite sure, are we out of it yet?
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the tone of the three voices that we talked to, and I want to go back to them and get their numbers in just a moment. I mean, is this an argument for the federal government maybe providing an incentive to more than just first-time home buyers or extending this? I mean, I'm a little worried that on November 30th, we're going to see an even bigger drop in home sales.
Well, it would be difficult to overstate the government's involvement in the housing market. In the third quarter, it looks like about 90% of all mortgages will be guaranteed, securitized, insured, held by the federal government. You couple that with this general this home buyer sort of tax credit, you have a major financial contribution. I think there's no question, as you look at the housing market, it's still fragile. So the withdrawal of any of the government support could undermine the recovery. Huh. On the other hand, one has to ask the question, how sustainable is this level of government support over the long term?
Right. Well, that's the great question.
This kind of government support tells us the market isn't healthy to operate on its own, and that's still a worry.
And that's a takeaway. The federal government is buying 90 and securitizing 90% of the mortgages at this current level. Nicholas Ritsinas is professor and director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Okay, homework time. Ken Ebaugh, how many customers did you deal with in the last couple of months that were pulled off the fence because of that $8,000 federal tax credit?
I would say there was an additional 40% of my customers that, if to give you a general number, if I were to close 8 to 10 transactions in a month, now there would probably be 14 to, 17. It just depends on my wife is a realtor in the area, and she has seen a great drive to push towards purchasing a home at this point because if people want to take advantage of the tax credit and get into the game.
Ken, I know how cagey you have to be in the real estate game. I understand totally, but I'm hearing a number about the 7 or 8 there. Okay, right, Ken?
Oh, sure.
Okay, great. Behrouz, how many people would it take for you to say this is a turnaround?
At least, in a monthly basis, at least if I have 3 more people talking to me about it, to 5 more people, I would look at it more optimistically. People talk, but if the transaction occurs, that's
so that's an average of 4 people.
Yeah, that's 4. And you don't sound very happy, Behrouz. I mean, the last time we spoke to you, you were like really over the moon because you're such a straight-ahead business person, but you don't sound happy this morning.
I came back to the earth.
Whoa. There's your takeaway. All right, Eric Mattinson, a banker from Greensboro and owner of a new home. All right, what was the number, payment, interest rate, or home price that brought you back in here?
I can give them all to you. I wanted in the ballpark of 5.25. I didn't. I wanted my payment with everything escrow to be $900. And the price, with those figures had to be in the ballpark of 130.
All right. So. And they got you there, obviously.
Yep.
Well, Eric Mattinson, thanks so much. Banker from Greensboro, North Carolina. Behrouz Shahidi is a real estate agent in New Jersey. And Ken Ebaugh, senior mortgage banker with Paramount Bank in Detroit, Michigan. Ken, Behrouz, and Eric, thanks so much.
No problem. Have a great morning.
Pretty interesting stuff, Nick. We're going to have to take this data and, think about it and talk to you next month.
Yeah, sure. Again, I think this is probably the big takeaway from those conversations are it's a little too early to take out the balloons.
Yes.
I don't think we're ready to declare victory yet.
He's come back to
Keeping
Earth.
Keeping the balloons in our desk. Nicholas Ritsinas, professor and director of the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University. Come on, give us some more data points. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Go outside. Take a look on your block. How many for sale signs are there? Are there boarded up homes? Are there vacant lots? Are there foreclosures taking place there? Give us the exact picture, and we're putting them together on our website, thetakeaway.org. Email us or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Nothing is over until we decide it is!
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway
from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Now some quick takeouts on stories we're following this week and want you to be current on. We've got Ibrahim Abdelmateen and Louise Story in the studio. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Where are you, Todd?
Oh, I'm in Washington.
You should be up here. And give us the latest episode on the Senate Finance Committee's attempts to pass or focus a very unwieldy health care bill.
Today is kind of a big day. In fact, John, it might be the biggest day so far in the markups because today is public option day. We've been talking about it all week. You know, the public option is not going to get into this bill. Max Baucus doesn't think it can get 60 votes. Well, here come the liberals. Jay Rockefeller, West Virginia, Chuck Schumer of New York have said today they're offering public option amendments. And believe it or not, they're making declarative statements declaring, predicting victory. Maybe not in the committee today to get public option on the bill, but they say they'll keep fighting for it and that they're going to bring it to the floor. They have guarantees to have votes on it on the floor. Schumer says this one's going to come down to the wire, and he predicts the public option will be in the final bill.
Hmm. Well, you say here come the liberals in the Senate. They're way more liberals in the House. What's going on over there?
Yeah, well, it's also sort of public option day in the House, too. Big House leadership meeting this morning to put together what might be the final aspects of this bill. And Democrats have some wind at their back now. It's funny. I want you to listen to a Congressman, Jim Moran, senior congressman from Virginia.
I don't think there's much question, but you'd have all three bills melded by next week. I think there still is some question when it would come to the floor. The leadership certainly isn't going to lose a vote this important.
The leadership isn't going to lose a vote this important. What he's saying is that they're having a big, it's expected to be a long meeting this morning. They're hoping to come out of there with a final, not with a final bill necessarily, but knowing what is going to be in the bill. Then the process of rounding up all the votes begins. And the reason the public option is important here, as you said, John, the House liberals very much want a strong public option. They're not backing down. They're not interested in triggers. The CBO just yesterday afternoon said it would save $110 billion on the bill. They've got some wind at their back now.
$110 billion in savings. There's your takeaway. Thank you, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Let's turn now to Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Well, we heard a very short time ago that the banks made record profits off of overdraft fees, but now a little bit of good news. Citigroup, at least, is cutting back on its number of overdraft fees. This is good news, right?
Hi, guys. What you're seeing is a change in the banking business model. It used to be the more customers, the better, because the banks could lend money. Right, it was volume. But now they want fewer, more profitable customers. They want people to do more different transactions with them, more types of business. So for once, they're trying to make their customers happy.
Interesting.
So it's these consumer-friendly policies like reining in the overdraft fees. Of course, part of it is motivated. You know, we're hearing about what's going on in Washington by the G20. You know, lawmakers breathing down their back, trying to look good. But I think they know about the public anger out there. I kind of look at my reader email as a litmus test. You know, I get readers from all kinds of people in the banks. And people have always been annoyed at the banks. I mean, think when you got that fee, you're annoyed. But since the bailout, I think people feel justified in their anger. It's like, you know, we saved you guys.
Yeah.
So why are you ripping me off? So people feel like empowered in their anger at the banks and the
say
banks.
Say that again. Say that again. That's great.
We saved you. Why are you ripping us off?
Why are you ripping us off? That's great.
I'm just telling you, this is what the readers say, not
right.
me.
Yeah, yeah.
But they feel strongly. And so the banks are trying to show a little love. They're just trying to show a little love, win a little goodwill here.
Citigroup only so far. Are some other banks going to follow suit?
Well, actually, the ones who really led this were Bank of America and JP Morgan. They came out first. And what they've said is, you know, JP Morgan said, if you only go over by less than $5, we won't charge you. Bank of America went even higher. They said, as long as you're under $10, we won't charge you. And Bank of America, you know, they've actually taken another unusual step. They have appointed an executive who is in charge of just consumer advocacy. I actually met with him yesterday in Washington, and it was interesting hearing about why they're doing this. And it's because they want someone who has connections to people on the ground, to public watchdogs, to connect it to the product line. So they're really kind of stepping out, showing a little love, you know.
Love from the banks.
Right.
The big story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
And now, on Friday, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen talks football with us. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
Let's take a look at the college game. Last night, Ole Miss was in the rankings and raring to go against South Carolina. What happened?
A thing called special teams, which every college football player always hears about, called special teams.
Isn't that special?
Special teams. Ole Miss literally just couldn't get it done on special teams or on offense. Their offensive line couldn't make it happen. And South Carolina got a huge upset.
And it seems to me that this is another sign of what you were talking about earlier this week, of the absurdity of the college rankings this early in the season. Ole Miss didn't really belong in the top 20.
Well, the other thing about it is also the conference. So when you start looking at a college football team, if you remember your alma mater, you're out there, you want to support them, check out what conference they're in. Sometimes the conference that they're in is really competitive, and the SEC is very dangerous. So at any given moment, any team could win or lose in that conference.
All right, so South Carolina had a big night last night. Of course, the Washington Huskies beat USC. Let's call some upsets for this weekend.
Well, there's a good game with Virginia Tech versus Miami. I really like Miami in this one. Because of a guy named Craig Cooper and Travis Benjamin and Ja'Cory Harris. Ja'Cory Harris is a sophomore quarterback. He's playing great football. There's also Cal versus Oregon, and that game I'm really looking forward to because you guys know I've been following Cal a little bit this year.
Yeah. And so our producer Colin, he's crazy.
And Oregon was started off the year as one of the teams that everyone was figuring was vying for the national championship. So this is a game with a lot of implications, particularly within
Oregon.
The conference.
I went to Oregon for a couple of years.
So there we go.
Go Ducks. Go Ducks.
So that should be a good game to watch. There's a couple other games. I'm looking at Boise State versus Bowling Green. When you talk about the rankings, you wonder, does Boise State really have the schedule to really be that high in the rankings?
Well, they did a huge upset a couple of years ago, didn't they?
They did. And I think, in general, their program has steadily been improving over the years. And so it's one of those things like Rutgers a couple of years ago, like Marshall, a couple years ago, where you start to see a program develop, and it's kind of like the rankings are saying, hey, you can get up here, you can play with the big boys. I wonder really if they can play with the big boys.
Well, Boise's a great community. We wish them very, very well. So what's the nickname of Wayne Gretzky, what do they call him?
The Great One.
Yeah, the Great One, but not as a coach, eh?
He hasn't had, the Great One, you're right, he stays out of the public glare, he's not a drama guy, but he hasn't had the success as a coach that he had as a player.
He stepped down as head coach and director of hockey operations for the Phoenix Coyotes. Will anyone pick him up?
I think he probably had offers from every team that probably even had a coach at the same time. You want a guy in the huddle that can get people reared and ready to go, and I think Wayne Gretzky is one of the best.
Well, thanks for that football takeout, and thank you, Louise. And Todd Zwillick, thank you. Thanks for that. Coming up, Barney Frank joins us. The Massachusetts congressman talks about reforming banks and protecting customers. He's probably not going to show a lot of love like Citigroup
did. Should. Show the love.
Stay tuned for that in a few minutes.
Good morning.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, Barney Frank talks turkey about how to regulate U.S. banks. That's in just a moment. Right now, here are some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes after the hour. At the G20 summit today, President Obama and the leaders of France and Britain will accuse of Iran of building a secret facility to produce nuclear fuel.
Fed up and you know it, smash the state!
That's the sound of protesters on the sidelines at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, where Barack Obama is expected to speak momentarily. We also have economic news out this morning. Durable goods orders down 2.4% after rising almost 5% in July. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, one of the things they're discussing at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh is bank reform. We've heard there's a deal to possibly limit bank salaries. But here in the United States, Congressman Barney Frank is weighing all the different options for regulating the banking industry. He's a Democrat from 4th Congressional District of Massachusetts and head of the House Financial Services Committee. The plan is to create a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency that would overhaul the country's financial regulation. Representative Frank, good morning.
Good morning.
So what is this Consumer Financial Protection Agency going to be responsible for? Are we going to be responsible for things like the nitty-gritty, overdraft fees, and those kind of things? Or we're talking about big sweeping reforms?
Well, we are talking about big sweeping reforms because the Consumer Agency is only a part of it. We have already passed in the House a very tough bill that would lead to that would require improvement in executive compensation. As we've anticipated what they're talking about at the G20, we have passed that. We have another bill that's going to restrict the irresponsible responsible use of derivatives, which caused so much of a problem. That was the AIG issue. We will be creating a new systemic risk regulator that will be empowered to look across the system at the kind of things that could cause problems.
But so the consumer... The devil's really in the details here, isn't it? I mean, there was a commentary in the Wall Street Journal complaining about the fact that you're going to end up with 50 Elliott Spitzers because you're going to give so much power to state attorney generals. You're going to have federal regulations, and then you're going to have state regulations, and these attorney generals are going to be able to prosecute banks not only in the state level, but prosecute them through the federal laws as well. Are we going to end up with so much prosecution the banks will be afraid to act?
No, not at all. That's really, frankly, not very serious conversation when people say that. In the first place, again, I want to avoid a confusion. The consumer agency is only a part of what we're doing. You ask me again, is it sweeping or just nitty-gritty? There are major proposals, and those, by the way, would all be national in terms of restricting leverage and derivatives. There will be uniformity there. The consumer agency is more narrowly focused, and it's one of several pieces of this, to protect consumers from credit card abuse, and we've already begun to move on that with a piece of legislation, from overdraft fees that are excessive. We have a lot of consumer laws on the books, and here's the problem. The consumer laws we have on the books in the financial industry are administered today by the same agencies that are in there to essentially regulate the banks overall. And the history has been that the Federal Reserve or the control of the currency, they simply don't give consumer protection a very high priority. They're focused, given their basic mission, on the safety and soundness of the banks, the way banks run. So what this bill will do is to transfer enforcement to an entity for whom that'll be the primary purpose. Secondly, there are a lot of institutions outside of the banks that do financial work. And in fact, if you look at the community banks, the small banks, they really haven't caused any problems. They are not the issue here as much as the non-banks that have been totally unregulated, people who made subprime loans or largely outside the banks.
Are you going to be able to successfully separate the community banks from the larger banks that you're targeting?
Well, we've done that in a number of ways already.
How do you do that?
Well, by answering your question. For instance, let me say the main thing we're going to be doing here that is going to be very helpful for the community banks is to adopt a system of regulating the non-bank, non-regulated competitors who are, frankly, worse for both the consumer and the economy. We've already passed legislation in the House to restrict the non-bank mortgage lenders. And as I said, they're the ones who overwhelmingly gave the bad loans that led to this kind of crisis. We will be dealing with people who do check cashing and payday lenders. If you get a check cash at a check cashing agency, you're almost certainly paying a lot more for that than you would if you did in a bank. So that's a major thing we'll be doing. This new consumer agency will have the power to regulate a number of institutions now that are not regulated very well by anybody. As far as the big bank, small bank, one of the things we will be doing is, in terms of the financing there, looking at ways to protect the smaller banks. Beyond that, it's the big banks that do derivatives. As I said, the consumer agency is only a part of what we're doing. We will be severely restricting what we think has been irresponsibility in the derivative market. The legitimate use of derivatives will go forward. That's a big bank issue. Credit cards, we've passed tough legislation. The community banks don't issue credit cards. So those are the ways we'll be dealing with that.
So we had this proposal that showed up in Politico from Walt Minnick of Idaho and the other Blue Dog Democrats, and they wanted to create a council of regulatory agencies, and they'd originally said that you supported this idea, and you asked Politico to retract that. What was wrong with this? They presented it as...
Let me correct the situation. It was not the Blue Dogs in general. It was Mr. Minnick, who's a very thoughtful guy, but I disagree with him on this issue. He never said that I supported it. He said that I was open to discussing it. That was wrong. He is the one who also corrected it. I didn't ask Politico to correct it, by the way. He did, because he realized that he had misrepresented my position. And the problem with that council is exactly why we need to have the agency. The council that he proposed, and by the way, it was not a Blue Dog General proposal, it was Mr. Minnick's, the council that he proposed would be exactly the regulators who now do this and don't do it very well. The problem here is, and with regard to banks, we're not talking about vast new regulation. We're talking about trying to get enforcement of the rules that are already on the books. And the problem, again, is this. The Federal Reserve System has the major statutory responsibility for consumer protection. Frankly, the people on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors are interested in global economic issues. They're interested in macroeconomic policy. They set interest rates. They don't really have a lot of time or energy or incentive to do consumers. So Mr. Minnick's proposal would have institutionalized the current situation where the people whose primary job is bank regulation overall would continue to do the consumer protection, and they do that, frankly, as a second, it's a secondary issue to them.
So one last quick question for you. When you first came in as the chair of the House Financial Services Committee, you said Congress's goal is to provide the private sector with goals but not mandate how to meet them. Have you changed their mind?
We've changed our minds in a couple of cases, yeah. We have had since that time, which was 2006, the meltdown, and we have learned more about abusive practices. So I would say this. We are not telling them how to do it. We are telling them, and this is the change, some things not to do. We're not going to be ordering them to do certain things, but we are going to provide better protection against things that led to trouble.
Congressman Barney Frank, Democrat from the 4th District of Massachusetts. Coming up, what to see, what to avoid at the box office this weekend. Stay with us.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley.
My name is Karen. I'm calling from Detroit. Frankly, I don't care whether I have health insurance. I want health care.
So as senators and lobbyists slog through hundreds of amendments on health reform, 564 to be exact, people like Karen are stuck in the middle. And her point has been echoed by many of you. Having insurance doesn't mean you're covered. There is a difference between health insurance and health care.
My name is Heather. I'm from Allen Park, Michigan, and I lost my health care in October. I did the responsible thing and went on the private market for my family. I was able to get it for my husband and myself. However, they would not cover my son. So he is now on Medicaid as well. I am on Medicaid because I am also pregnant, which my health insurance doesn't cover.
We've heard your stories at 8778MYTAKE on what you want your health care to do for you. We heard from someone who couldn't get the care she wanted, but still got treated.
And my insurance company was bought by another one, and I went to the doctor afterwards, and there was a problem with my shoulder, and he wanted to get an MRI, and they said no, and then I just went straight to physical therapy, and it fixed me, you know, fixed the problem anyway. So I had to give up a medical procedure, but I still got the care I needed.
We also heard a story about what happens when coverage doesn't go far enough, as in miles.
My name is Michael. Generally, we're very happy with our current plan through our employer. However, there are idiosyncrasies. For example, our daughter recently had knee surgery. She went back to college in another state and was told by the insurance company that she could not have physical therapy in that state because it was out of the service area.
One listener told us she can see the doctor she wants. Well, that's good news, but it's not good that she can't see them when she wants to.
This is Penny from Oklahoma City. I've been trying to make an appointment for my children to see specialists. I've been given an appointment for my daughter for the 15th of December. And let me say that in the 10 years I lived in England and lived under the National Health System, I never, ever had to wait that long. If that is what socialism is, then bring it on.
Even the simplest issues can get complicated when you deal with insurance companies. That's what we heard from one of you.
This is Katie. I have a situation where I pay for my own health care, which doesn't seem to give me much health care in return, including no preventative care in the first 12 months. And I had a situation recently where I had a wart on my hand that I desperately wanted to get rid of, which of course was not covered under my insurance. And my dermatologist told me it was going to cost me $1,500 out of pocket, which I did not have. And after a few minutes kind of Googling around, I found out that you can treat them with apple cider vinegar, which I did, and it only cost me a little over a dollar.
So are you getting what you pay for? You think that paying a premium insulates you against disaster, but when one person faced tragedy, those years of monthly payments meant nothing.
My name is Tim Rhodes. I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. I would say my insurance has been a nightmare at the age of 49. I found out I had an aggressive prostate cancer with 12 to 36 months to live. My insurance company immediately said it was a pre-existing and denied coverage. I now have, from the treatment for the 8 months, 60 medical bills, and it's a fiscal and financial nightmare.
It's a nightmare that might happen to you, or might not. But when you hear these stories, stories from our listeners across America, can you be sure you're covered?
We need affordable health care, not affordable health insurance. In fact, having health insurance has become the 800-pound gorilla in the room, and health has become more a case of less care and more insurance.
Tell us your story. If you have health insurance, are you getting the care you need? Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up, the best movies to see this weekend, and we're going to have a trivia question. Here it is. Think about it now. The category Pacino's Women named the female leads who played opposite Al Pacino in the following three movies: Godfather, Scarface, and Sea of Love. We'll see if Rafer Guzman and Karina Longworth can answer that question in just a few minutes. Now, some of the news stories we're following at 48 minutes after the hour. Right now, President Obama is speaking at the G20 summit. It's highly anticipated remarks in Pittsburgh. He's talking about Iran's nuclear program.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been building a covert uranium enrichment facility near Qom for several years. Earlier this week, the Iranian government presented a letter to the IAEA that made reference to a new enrichment facility years after they had started its construction. The existence of this facility underscores Iran's continuing unwillingness to meet its obligations under UN Security Council resolutions and IAEA requirements.
So we also have some bad economic news this morning as the G20 summit is continuing there in Pittsburgh. Barack Obama speaking there just a moment ago. Other world leaders have taken the podium. Bad economic news, big ticket factory orders down 2.4%, much worse than predicted. It's moving the markets, and NASDAQ futures are down almost 8 points this morning.
A Colorado man charged with a bombing plot is back in court today. Investigators say he planned to turn common chemicals into bombs. And Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is in stable condition in a hospital this morning. She became lightheaded yesterday after treatment for an iron deficiency. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Let's go out to dinner and see a movie. Let's go out to dinner and see a movie.
Well, it's Friday, and that means it's time to talk about movies that you want to see or may want to avoid. Over the weekend, we have Takeaway contributors Karina Longworth. She's the editor of the Movie and Culture Review blog Spout. And Rafer Guzman is film critic for Newsday in the studio. Well, let's get a few movies out of the way right away. I think we can do that quickly. Let's start with our supposed three blockbusters. Surrogates, that's the one with Bruce Willis and the robots.
Right.
Fame and Pandorum. Not much to say about Pandorum because they haven't showed it to anyone
yet. Yeah, they didn't screen it for critics, which is never a good sign.
Never a good sign. And then we have Surrogates and Fame, and there was a review from MSNBC that says, it's a shame that Fame is so lame. So have you guys seen Fame, and is it as lame as they say?
I did not see Fame. I actually had to review the U2 concert that night, which I think was a better gig.
A much
Karina?
Better assignment.
I have not seen Fame, but I always trust alliteration.
And the last one here is the Bruce Willis film Surrogates, where everyone is replaced by a robot. This one also not getting good reviews.
Yeah, four words: Bruce Willis, bad wig.
Okay, so let's move on to some movies that you guys actually like. We're going to start with Blind Date. This is Stanley Tucci. He not only stars in this movie, but he directed it as well.
I died when I was 5. We were in a car accident. My mother was driving, and my father was singing in the passenger seat. He was making her laugh.
This is a very different concept
sad.
from the, well, it is. It's
like Lovely Bones or something. You have talking to come, from the dead.
Hang on a second, John.
Another Stanley Tucci movie, by the way.
What's really going on here is that these are two people who are trying to recapture their marriage after their daughter died.
That's right. The death has driven some sort of a wedge between them, and they've lost their intimacy together. And so, you know, as a solution, they essentially start going on a series of blind dates. One will place an ad in the newspaper. The other will answer. They'll show up. They'll start to get to know each other again. They'll talk about themselves in character.
Right. They're always pretending to be someone else.
Yes, exactly. They keep their names, Don and Jana. They keep their names each time, but they pretend to be different types of people each time. And so it's a way for them to get to know each other, and little by little, you also come to understand what exactly it is that went wrong in the marriage.
This could be very cutesy if it starred two other different stars, but does it work?
I mean, it's a great chance to see these two supporting actors in lead roles, you know, and they're both just
terrific.
Stanley
Tucci and Patricia
Clarkson. Yes.
Cool.
And they're both fantastic, and they get to do everything. They get to be sad and angry and very funny, and there's these some very nice scenes of kind of erotic tension between the two. They're very warm with each other, but also they're very cold and pull away. It can be a little drama clubby at times. They'll break character. They'll go back into character. And there's an air of tragedy that hangs over the film that I found a little forced. But just to see the two of them playing off each other in different roles each time is pretty extraordinary.
Okay, and another movie, Karina, that's coming out is Disgrace. This is with John Malkovich. And the plot itself seems, when you read it, to be extremely complicated. Can we kind of let's listen to a clip first and then try to get through this story.
Do you know why my daughter sent me to you?
She told me you're in trouble.
Not just trouble, I suppose one would call it disgrace.
So Rafer,
I'd listen to Malkovich read the telephone book, wouldn't you, Karina?
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
But you know, Rafer, this plot seems complicated.
I'll try to be brief. It begins with Malkovich, who's a university professor in Cape Town, South Africa. He's an inveterate womanizer.
Right.
He goes to bed with one of his students, a mixed-race student. It's a sort of a semi-consensual
affair. And gets
fired. And he gets fired, which would be enough for one movie, you'd
right.
think. But then he winds up going to live with his daughter, who's a lesbian. They live on a farm, and then they're promptly attacked by three very young black boys, and she's raped. And basically the rest of the movie is about Malkovich trying to come to terms with that and what's happened to him and what's happened to his daughter.
So a very thoughtful movie. Karina, if we're going to send people out to see a movie this weekend, what should it be?
I really like Coco Before Chanel, which is a biopic of the early life of the fashion designer. It stars Audrey Tautou from Amelie. And it's I like to think of it as a guilty pleasure for smart people. It's kind of like Sex and the City for people who are appalled by Sex and the City.
And
it's
got,
but it's great history. It is great history.
It is, and it's got the fashion. It's got romance from both a romantic and an unsentimental point of view. And it's just a really interesting portrait of an actually complicated woman.
You get to see Coco Chanel in quotes singing and dancing.
It's true. She starts out as a wannabe cabaret singer.
And is she really that short?
She's very small.
She's very, very small. All right, trivia time, guys. All right, the question is, Pacino's women, name the female leads who played opposite Al Pacino in the following three movies. You can call it out, all right? Godfather?
Diane Keaton.
Oh, Michael. Michael, you are blind. It wasn't a miscarriage. It was an abortion.
All right, how about Scarface?
Michelle Pfeiffer?
Nice.
Don't toot your horn, honey. You're not that good.
And here's the hard one. Sea of Love.
Ellen Parkin.
I don't believe in wasting time on this kind of stuff. You know what you know and you go with it.
That's 3 for 3. You guys are fantastic. Karina Longworth, editor of the Movie and Culture Review blog Spout, and Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. That's for the weekend, but just a few minutes ago, we want to remind you, President Barack Obama spoke at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh. He was responding, along with the leaders of France and Britain, to new reports this morning, we've been reporting them all morning, that Iran has built a second secret facility to produce nuclear fuel. The UN knows about it. Now world leaders want that facility inspected. Here's President Obama.
All nations have the right to peaceful nuclear energy. Those nations with nuclear weapons must move towards disarmament. Those nations without nuclear weapons must forsake them. That compact has largely held for decades, keeping the world far safer and more secure. And that compact depends on all nations living up to their responsibilities. This site deepens a growing concern that Iran is refusing to live up to those international responsibilities.
Again, Iran had previously acknowledged having only one such uranium enrichment facility. The news comes ahead of high-level talks between the U.S. and Iran next week on its nuclear program, a very high-stakes chess game on nukes with Iran and the United States. We'll continue watching this story. We're also looking for your stories when it comes to your neighborhood. After 4 months of gains, national housing sales were down last month, so just go outside and take a look at what housing changes you're seeing on your block.
My name is Dorian, and I'm in New York. The big picture for me was at the Queens Museum, where there was an exhibit where there were flags showing any block where there were three or more foreclosures, and you could just see the cluster of flags in the poorer neighborhoods of New York.
You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
My name's John, and I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. We're about 11 miles from downtown, which means that we see absolutely none of the money or effort that's allegedly being put into making Detroit a better place. We're left to fend for ourselves. Luckily, I live on a block that's about 60% vacant, but the 40% of us that remain work hard to keep it nice. We take care of the yards that are in abandoned homes and try to keep the strippers away as much as possible.
Wow. 877-8-MY-TAKE. That is a vivid picture from a neighborhood in Detroit.
Work hard and keep the strippers away.
Reach us with an email, if you like, at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Talk about anything you've heard on the show. Go to our website and listen to a very vigorous conversation about whether Jay-Z is the greatest in hip-hop.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. You might call it an emergency at the beauty parlor.
Thank God y'all open. I got a wedding to get to in 3 hours.
I'll hook you up. Oh. Let me see who we working with under this hat.
Yeah, I'm having some Don King issues.
Federal investigators have some much bigger issues with terror suspects who allegedly tried to buy chemicals for explosives at beauty parlors.
What's he gonna do, Bray, just scout?
There's only one place that can change your whole look.
Terror makeovers and very bad hair days on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, September 25th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. We've seen footage of the police in Pittsburgh spraying protesters with pepper spray. We're going to be talking to some of the protesters, find out what it is that's motivating them. We'll also preview some of the weekend football action, and we'll talk to a gay teen who came out at age 12. Is there ever an age that is too young for someone to come out?
But first, Ed O'Callaghan joins me. He's a former federal prosecutor, chief of the Terrorism and National Security Unit in New York's Southern District. We were making sport of it, talking about bad hair days there at the top. But Ed, suddenly the feds have to watch all kinds of chemicals. What explosive chemicals can you buy at beauty parlors and supply stores?
Good morning, John. The products that you can get really are hydrogen peroxide-based products and acetone-based products. In this particular case, they listed ion-sensitive scalp developer and liquid developer Claroxide as two of the products that were purchased.
And the FBI apparently has pictures of those suspects actually doing it, the ones who were arrested in Denver, Colorado. Ed O'Callaghan, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
In the headlines, President Obama demands that Iran let inspectors into a second secret nuclear enrichment plant. In a news conference just moments ago, President Obama said the U.S. knew about it.
The existence of this facility underscores Iran's continuing unwillingness to meet its obligations under UN Security Council resolutions.
The president was joined by the leaders of France and Britain. They threatened new sanctions against Iran. In economic news, orders for big-ticket manufacturing goods way down. The drop surprised forecasters who'd expected a jump this month. The numbers are moving the markets.
There was a 2.4% drop. That was significant. Investigators say the Colorado man charged in that terror plot we just mentioned may have had collaborators, but the Attorney General, Eric Holder, says any threat from the plot has been disrupted. Police are bracing for more protests at the G20 summit today. Some got out of hand yesterday. Police fired rubber bullets and tear gas into a group of protesters who were breaking windows and throwing rocks. Cops made dozens of arrests. Overseas, 5 American troops are dead after attacks in southern Afghanistan. And Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is in a hospital this morning. She became lightheaded yesterday after treatment for an iron deficiency. Earlier this year, she had pancreatic cancer surgery. She's said to be in serious condition.
Wall Street dipped a bit yesterday. The Dow opens at 97.07. The S&P will start trading at 10.51, and the NASDAQ begins at 21.08. So after 4 months of gains in national housing sales, last month, things went down. We're going to go beyond those official statistics, though, and get a snapshot of your situation on your block. We're asking listeners, what's it look like where you are?
My name is Carolyn, and I live in Decatur, Georgia. And on my block, there is only one house for sale. Everyone seems to be staying pretty well put. That's a good thing in this area.
8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. We have disturbing developments in the terrorism case out of Colorado. Najib Boulazizi, a 24-year-old Afghan living there, was indicted yesterday in New York on conspiracy charges related to alleged plots to detonate homemade bombs in the New York subway system. Much more serious charges than lying to investigators. According to government documents, Zazi bought large amounts, gallons, of acetone and hydrogen peroxide from beauty supply stores around the area. He was supposedly experimenting with bomb making in a Denver area hotel room. He's also accused of having 9 pages of instructions stored in his computer about how to make those explosives. Currently, Zazi's in Denver, Colorado, where he's awaiting a court hearing that would have him transferred to New York City. Joining us now is Bruce Finley. He's a staff writer for the Denver Post. Bruce, tell me what's going on. From what we understand, the federal agents visited beauty supply stores all around Denver looking for places that he may have bought these chemicals.
Good morning, Celeste. We don't have any specific addresses for the hotel where he apparently was cooking the chemicals or which stores, although clerk at one of the stores says he asked him why he was buying so much, and he said he had a lot of girlfriends. I went by the apartment where Najib Boulazizi lived with his father, Mohammed, the day before yesterday. There was an eviction notice posted on the door. The apartment managers are moving to evict them. It's unclear exactly what their grounds are for that. They say there was a problem with people living in the apartment who weren't listed on the lease. There's the white van shuttle that Najib Boulazizi drove to and from Denver International Airport is still parked out front. Gen X ball cap on the dashboard, back support by the seat. Nearby, there are lots of shoes on the porch of a somewhat besieged family of relatives at the home where Najib Boulazizi initially stayed when he moved from New York to Denver.
Najib Boulazizi's father was released from jail. What has been the reaction of the Afghan community in Denver, which is relatively large?
Well, some of the fellow shuttle drivers reacted, also Afghanistan-born men reacted sort of incredulously as word of the documents that were unsealed spread yesterday. The operations manager of the company that employed him since March said, it all sounds so funny. I don't think so. He's not that smart to build a bomb, that guy. He's a kid.
Huh.
There's a feeling that of a little bit of disbelief. In the early days, some of the Muslim community leaders I talked to, allowed that they were cringing somewhat because they thought it might be another case where the government was perhaps going overboard and, they'd had a sense of being looked at too closely just because of their country of origin rather than hard evidence. But now some of the community leaders have told me that, they're thinking more carefully about how this could be happening right in our midst out here.
I think a lot of us are thinking more carefully. Thanks. That's Bruce Finley. He's a staff writer for the Denver Post. Also joining us is David Johnston, a reporter with our partner, the New York Times, and, of course, Ed O'Callaghan, former federal prosecutor and chief of the Terrorism and National Security Unit in New York's Southern District. He's now a partner at the law firm Nixon Peabody. So, David, let me start with you. A lot of us are now thinking very differently about this case. Many people thought, because he was only charged with lying to investigators, that this was going to be one of those terrorism cases that fizzled out eventually, but it's much more serious than we thought.
So it appears to be. I think there were indications from the start that this was going to turn into a more serious case, and that the initial charges were really placeholders that were there while the investigation went from this covert phase to overt. And I think it was not surprising that there were more serious charges. But one of the documents released yesterday seriously upped the ante in this whole matter by talking about his actually moving from having plans to do something and training to actually going out and acquiring and buying the kind of chemicals needed to build the very same kinds of explosives that were used in the London subway bombings and what were going to be used in the airplane attacks from based in the UK a year ago.
So, Ed, you heard Bruce Finley talking about people saying that Najibullah is not smart enough to create a bomb, but we're also hearing that he got expert advice. Is it really that difficult for him to have built it?
Well, that's what some of the evidence that the prosecutors have laid out in their recent documents do show, that he had instructions on his computer as to how to combine the components of the hydrogen peroxide and acetone. And so it appears that he had a document that would give him the step-by-step instructions as to do it correctly. The other thing that the prosecutors laid out in their document was that they intercepted emails. The computer evidence that they have recovered really does provide a treasure trove of evidence for them to use going forward. In some of those emails, they laid out that he engaged in email exchanges with others, unnamed at this point, in which he asked for urgent instructions as to how to combine the products properly so that they were effective. So all of that shows that he had the instructions to do it, and he had the communications with people, at least that he thought would help him do it properly.
Well, Ed, you sort of alluded to it there, but I want to comment from you and David, if we could. I mean, there is a pattern, and you're closer to these documents and these indictments than I am. But there's a pattern of urgency here where investigators began to conclude that he was moving towards actually doing something, and it involves these various communications that they intercepted. What were they using to gauge this urgency and the fact that this was about to come down?
Well, I think that, again, as the prosecutors laid out in the document, and again, you don't really know what the evidence is until there's an actual trial and the evidence is put into court, but it does appear that the investigators were looking at internet email exchanges. They also had telephone intercepts and surveillance. And those three combined surveillance techniques really do give investigators a pretty good window into how urgent the situation was.
Does that also set this apart, David Johnston?
Yeah, I'd say it was. And I think what we're looking at here is a case in which it appeared from the documents made public so far that the pace of his activity seemed to be accelerating. I should say I think it's important that to note that that the government officials in this case still seem to not have a sense of whether he had actually built a working bomb, whether he could actually pull it off, so to speak. But the pace of the activity seemed to be increasing, and that is what really does set this apart. I think that over the years, many people have developed an immunity of sorts to these kinds of cases because there have been so many assertions by government officials over the years that these were very dangerous people, but many of them did not seem to be such a grave danger when we really got to look at the details of these cases. This one appears to be very different.
Could we see more charges against Najib Bouzalzazi and in investigating are we going to hear more about these as of right now, unnamed others? In other words, would this investigation perhaps widen into a large terrorism investigation?
This is Ed O'Callaghan. The investigation is clearly ongoing. There are, as you said, others named, not named, but at least referred to in the papers. So investigators are clearly looking for other participants. And again, I would say that it is very early on in the investigation, and the evidence will be poured over to make sure that all charges that can be brought will be brought.
David, are we going to see further charges against Zazi?
I wouldn't be surprised at all. I mean, I think this is, as Ed says, this is very early. I think there's a great deal here that isn't known about his activities. certainly there are references to unidentified others in the charging documents yesterday. I think it's quite likely we're going to see further charges both in New York and possibly Denver.
So, Ed, a quick last question for you. In looking at the way this particular investigation has been led, is there a difference between the way the Obama administration is pursuing these cases as opposed to his former administration than the Bush administration?
No, I don't see a difference at all, quite frankly. What the prosecutors and the investigators do, the agents and the officers, is try to establish the building blocks during the course of the investigation to point them toward participants in a conspiracy and the proper charges. That is consistent throughout the course of no matter what administration is in place.
Ed O'Callaghan, former federal prosecutor and chief of the Terrorism and National Security Unit in New York's Southern District, now a partner at law firm Nixon Peabody. We are also joined by David Johnston at our partner, The New York Times. And I imagine we're going to be talking about this a lot.
You really want to ask our listeners, if you see people with a shopping cart buying large amounts of hydrogen peroxide, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But the serious question we're asking you this morning regards housing sales and how national housing sales were down last month unexpectedly. What are you seeing on your block? Lucy emails us, for all the grief we get, downtown Newark real estate values have held steady throughout this crisis. They remain very high in the venerable Ironbound neighborhood. There are many more for rent signs in my downtown neighborhood, not one for rent or for sale. Tell us what you're seeing at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Keep the conversation going with your thoughts. Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Now, some quick takeouts on some of the stories we're following this week. We're going to go to Washington first and go to Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Todd, let's update everyone on health care. We just talked about the Senate seat left vacant by the death of Edward Kennedy has now been filled, and this is going to change the whole thing, right?
Hasn't been filled yet. It'll be filled today officially. Paul Kirk coming to the Senate. Celeste, he'll be sworn in today. Vice President Joe Biden, who serves constitutionally, of course, as the president of the Senate, is due to come up on the Hill. Now, there is a legal challenge in Massachusetts. Republicans there are challenging the legislative and legal process by which Kirk was appointed by the governor. So barring any immediate injunctions or legal shenanigans, he should be sworn in today. You know, I've suggested that Kirk might consider being sworn in like a Harvard jersey. From Boston with a number 60 on the back, because that's what he is. He is number 60. He is the 60th vote on health care, and that's really why the Democrats are going to need him.
That's adorable, Todd.
So this stops everything. All the argument's over, right? This is the 60th vote they needed. Done deal. Health care finished, right?
Yeah, not even close, because today in the Finance Committee, the public option is going to come up legislatively for the first time, and not every Democrat wants that. That magic number of 60 is not locked down. And as we've been talking about, a lot of this rests on a Republican, Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine, who does not want a public option, but they really want her vote to guard against losing any Democrats and to maybe get you over that 60 line. Now, Olympia Snowe, instead of a public option, has proposed a trigger. You don't do the public option now, but if prices don't come down after a certain time, maybe we can do a trigger later. And the big question around the Hill, because the House and the Senate are so far apart, the House really wants the public option, the Senate doesn't. The big question is, will the Senate swallow a trigger, will the Senate swallow a public option? Will the House swallow a trigger? Where's the compromise? So you got to go to Madam Speaker and ask her what she thinks about the trigger.
If anybody wants to, I don't even want to talk about a trigger. When we are ready, I'll tell you where we're going to be. But let's go back to Afghanistan. Is that what you said?
The trigger got stuck in her throat there a little bit.
She'd rather talk about the war in Afghanistan than talk about the trigger.
That's
so that gives you an idea. Gives you an idea of where Madam Speaker Nancy Pelosi is on that idea. So those two bodies are still far apart, and the question ultimately will be, whose side is the president on? That's the question.
Well, Todd, looks like you need to get back up on the Hill and follow these things closely. Thanks so much. Todd Zwillig is the Takeaway Washington correspondent.
And our sports takeout comes from Takeaway sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We're talking, of course, about the NFL football weekend. First 2 weeks of the season, you can't really say anything about it. I mean, we talk a good game, but it's rule of threes in the NFL. Patterns start to develop, and we've got some comebacks happening on the West Coast this weekend.
Well, I want to tell you the stories that I'm following right now. A story that I wasn't really following until now, San Francisco versus the Vikings. Michael Crabtree is their number one draft pick, and he's still been holding out. He's got $20 million on the table, but he's still holding out. He's going to be watching San Francisco as they probably will have a tough game against the Vikings. There's also the New Orleans Saints versus the Buffalo Bills. I love that matchup because they're the two worst passing defenses in the league. And so you have it should be a game of fireworks, but I think the Bills are going to pull this one out. The Saints, led by Drew Brees, he's an amazing quarterback. A couple weeks ago, I said that Philip Rivers was Drew Brees. I confused the two, but Philip Rivers is the quarterback. Rivers is the quarterback for the San Diego Chargers, and Drew Brees is the quarterback for the New Orleans Saints. They're both high-rated passers. Another game that I'm following is Atlanta Falcons at the New England Patriots, and I'll tell you why, because the Patriots are going to exact some revenge after getting beaten last week.
They hope.
And then,
they look pretty bad. Like.
Exactly. So, and also, everyone in the country, particularly in Michigan, is rooting for their...
They could do it this weekend.
Well, it's a vigil.
They truly
it's,
could do it this weekend. The reason why...
Let's remind people what we're talking about here. This is a vigil for the Detroit Lions.
Who are at 19?
0-19. They haven't won a game for 19. They could actually change that this week.
Exactly, because they're playing a team that's deplorable in the
possibly worse.
Exactly, in the face of the Washington Redskins, so that should be an interesting game. And I'm really rooting for Detroit on this one. And then finally, obviously, Miami versus the San Diego Chargers. The only reason why I mention this game is because you're going to see the exact opposite type of offenses go against each other. The Chargers will be a high-flying offense, and Miami's going to be a grinded out. They're going to run the ball. Uh-huh. So,
well, you got the Chargers who struggled last week, it seems like. You got the San Francisco 49ers that seem to be doing well on the West Coast. What about that Broncos game? They're 2-0 and going up against the Oakland Raiders, and a lot of people on the West Coast would love to see the Raiders back into it. They haven't been into it in a while.
It's not just the West Coast. It's Raider Nation.
Yeah.
And Raider Nation, I think, is happier than they've ever been. And I honestly, that's one of the games that I'm really looking forward to because I think the Raiders are going to pull this one out.
Well, we shall see. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Thanks so much, as always.
All right, listeners, we're going to follow up with you now. There's a lot of conversation going on the website. We asked yesterday what message you would send to world leaders if they came to your town. There are so many around right now. We got lots of responses.
This is Scott. I live and work in Manhattan, and obviously we've had world leaders for the last week. And I tell them one thing, take public transit, ditch the SUVs, take the bus, take the subway.
Nicolas Sarkozy on the subway line.
On the subway.
We spoke to former nuclear weapons inspector Hans Blick yesterday. Jim wrote on the takeaway.org, you guys really missed a chance. You should have run a clip from the hilarious, though politically incorrect movie, Team America World Police. It's never too late, Jim.
In the case of North Korea, they are offered diplomatic relations.
Bricks! Oh, no!
Oh, that is so cheesy. Poor Hans Bricks.
Jim adds, and I want to point out this is Jim writing, the best part is where Kim Jong-il feeds Hans Bricks to the sharks. I promise, John.
Yeah.
I swear.
Yeah, you're lying, I think.
This is the last time we will talk about grilled cheese sandwiches.
Oh, no, please, more grilled cheese.
We finally have an Uber recipe on the website, combining all the ingredients you suggested. It has pickles. It's got fig jam.
Oh, my goodness.
You can look at it at thetakeaway.org.
All right, and what are you saying today? How your health insurance isn't giving you health care?
My name is Suzanne. I'm calling from Massachusetts, and I have insurance. I have great insurance, actually. And even with my insurance, I can never see my doctor. When I do try to see my doctor, I'm often referred to the emergency room for things like x-rays, sinus infections, I mean, basic care issues.
That says it all. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
My name is Elizabeth from New Jersey. For the most part, my health plan would cover a typical Western doctor. The problem is that I'm not interested in taking prescriptions that are basically sold to my doctor from pharmaceuticals. The kinds of doctors that I want, holistic treatment, they're not covered on my plan. So what am I supposed to do?
You know, that doesn't even get talked about in the debate. It's a great point. We're also talking about housing, what you're seeing on your block.
And, the housing numbers fell slightly, but what's it looking like at your block?
This is Santos Granados in Detroit, Michigan.
neighborhood at one point in time had 40 houses on a block, and now livable houses are about 10.
You guys are great. I mean, I'm really getting these vivid pictures in neighborhoods all over the country. You know, you put enough dots together, you have a picture.
Yeah, you start to see what it looks like across America.
Mm-hmm.
Keep the conversation going. 877-8-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Coming up, when Iran surprises the world with a surprise nuclear facility, there are repercussions in the international community to be, at the very least. Yes, indeed. We're going to talk about those in just a moment. But here are some of the news stories we're following at 33 minutes after the hour. In economic news, big ticket factory orders are down 2.4%, much worse than predicted. Later this morning, we're also going to get fresh data on consumer sentiment and new home sales.
In southern Afghanistan, 5 U.S. soldiers are dead after attacks in the south. 15 Iraqi soldiers are dead after a routine bomb disposal went wrong. The explosion happened in northern Iraq. And a Colorado man charged with plotting to explode bombs on U.S. soil is in a Denver court today. Federal authorities say they also have 2 other would-be bombers in custody in unrelated investigations.
So as we mentioned, President Obama is speaking out about that Iranian surprise nuclear site. Earlier this morning at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh, the president and other world leaders told Iran to open this newly disclosed enrichment facility to inspection. President Obama wants Iran to come clean at upcoming nuclear meetings.
Through this dialogue, we are committed to demonstrating that international law is not an empty promise, that obligations must be kept, and the treaties will be enforced.
Joining us now is Charlie Sennett, executive editor at Global Post. He joins us from Boston, Massachusetts, and Cindy Skrzycki, a correspondent for Global Post, who's in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at that G20 summit meeting. So, Cindy, all of a sudden, there's a big international story that has nothing to do with economics and everything to do with nuclear proliferation. Now, what do you make of it?
Well, it certainly was a surprise incredibly well-timed for Mr. Obama to be able to speak about, and certainly in the right venue, what kind of action will be taken on it or what role it'll continue to play through the meetings, we'll have to see.
Well, Charlie Sennett, executive editor at Global Post, I mean, you've seen played out at this G20 summit, which usually these summits do not make big headlines. It's more symbolic than anything else. A chess game being played by Iran and the United States, opening move, Iran discloses this facility. The response by Barack Obama is to say we need international inspectors at the very minimum. What do you make of it?
I think it's really important. This has been an incredible week for foreign policy, and this really sort of caps it, because it takes the central issues that the Obama administration faces. The biggest issues are Afghanistan, Iraq, and nuclear proliferation. Those are the top 3 foreign policy issues, and they all have one thing in common: Iran. So to see these 3 leaders sort of lock arms, you know, you got the United States, the United Kingdom, and France in Pittsburgh locking arms and saying we need to get inspectors in there, I think is a stronger move than the very defensive move that Ahmadinejad has made in announcing that it exists.
Right. So you think there was some sort of attempt to preempt what President Obama said this morning. Charlie, take me into your editorial meetings now. At Global Post, you potentially have the capability of getting one of the first pictures of this undisclosed facility, or at the very least, Iranian reaction to what's going on domestically in Iran. How are you going to work that out?
Well, we have the challenges that every news organization faces in getting a reporter to be able to be on the ground working in Iran. But we have a reporter right now in Dubai who, like every reporter, is trying very hard to get in there. We also have a correspondent who we do not name, who is in Iran and who we can also try to get some sort of street reaction from and maybe tap into what's happening there. But this is very hard to report on. The biggest thing right now on Iran, I think, will just be the dynamics of big foreign policy. How do we get China and how do we get Russia to help hold Iran's feet to the fire on the UN inspections?
Well, markets are open and they're down, reacting to economic news and probably this Iran story as well. Cindy Skrzycki, you've been reporting also on the protesters in Pittsburgh. Has this revelation really sort of taken the headlines? And I'm wondering if you're getting any reaction, even from the media there in Pittsburgh.
You know, this is likely to become an issue with the protesters. There is a big protest planned for early this afternoon by the Thomas Merton Center, and this is certainly something that I think is going to energize their march. This is a permitted march, but it's a very large one, and you know, they're going to go right through the center of Pittsburgh. So I think this is probably going to be a very energizing issue for them and other protesters here.
Tell us about the experience you had this morning with Michelle Obama. I guess you were at a pancake restaurant, which I suppose was something of a photo op, but how substantive was your encounter there?
Well, Mrs. Obama really, truly did try to sneak off to this restaurant, which is in Millvale. It's a very small town on the other side of the Allegheny River, not too far from where the summit is being held. And she literally blew in there at 8:40 with her security detail, about six staff people, and sat down at her and the president's favorite pancake place in Pittsburgh called Pamela's Diner. This is the same Pamela's that the president brought to the White House, the two women who own it, to make pancakes for him on Memorial Day weekend. So this has become something of a habit with Mrs. Obama and the president, and obviously he wasn't there because he was opening the summit
right.
and discussing the whole Iranian
right.
issue.
Sure,
but she seemed to be having a very good time and ordered plain pancakes.
It's hard to sneak when you've got a security
indeed.
Detail, though.
But it's that kind of detail that we love from Global Post. Charlie Sennett, let's get one more bit of reaction from you. Now, of course, on the table for months has been this offer from Barack Obama and the administration to have bilateral talks on a whole range of issues to basically reopen bilateral communications with the Iranians. Where do you think that stands right now?
Well, I think that all changed with the June election and the street protests that erupted in a surprising and startling way. They began recalibrating that idea from that point forward, and I think now they've shown that they're really rethinking it. And I think all of that is an intention that exists. It's sort of holding it out for Ahmadinejad to say, hey, if you want to come in from the cold, we will talk with you, but you're going to have to live up to the UN inspections.
Well, the question is, who's on the defensive here? If Ahmadinejad says, inspectors, fine, it's harder for Barack Obama to say, all right, we're going to shut down these bilateral talks. But if Ahmadinejad takes a hard line, this could be really just a setup for saying, nope, we're slamming the door. What do you think, Charlie?
I think you're right. I mean, this all sounds familiar, doesn't it? It sounds a lot like Iraq, 10 years ago. And
good point.
Yeah.
It's really interesting how we've changed the dynamics and the hydraulics, to use an oil metaphor, on dual containment. It's still the same operative theory at work that we have to contain Iran, we have to contain Iraq. But I still come back to this, that
quickly.
The Obama administration is going to have to step up its foreign policy. It's going to have to be a lot more clear. It's trying to do that right now on the ground in Pittsburgh, but it's got a lot of work to do.
Well, this could clarify things. So Charlie Sennett, executive editor at Global Post, and Cindy Skorzycki, correspondent for Global Post in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Cindy and Charlie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up, if you're gay, how young is too young to come out? It's a very serious choice for a lot of young people, and we're going to talk about it in just 10 minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headley. Well, we were at one Rust Belt city in Pittsburgh there, and now we're going to be talking about another, and that is the Rust Belt city, Detroit. There's an unprecedented movement to a certain extent. Time Warner has decided to send reporters from Time, Fortune, Money, Essence, and Sports Illustrated, and CNN Money, that's one of the websites, on an assignment Detroit. They've purchased a home there. They're sending all of their reporters to live in Detroit in order to cover the stories coming out of there. Joining us right now is Daniel Okrent, former editor and writer for Time, Inc., former public editor for The New York Times. I should say he's a native Detroiter. He joins us from Massachusetts. Daniel, you're writing the cover article on Detroit for Time. So why is your company investing in this project to report on Detroit?
Well, we think it's a huge story. It's the sort of story that people may not be noticing because it unfolds slowly over many, many years. It's not brush fires. It's not a hurricane and a flood, but it is equally or even more destructive, and we need to know more about it. Americans need to know more about it.
You know, I have been in Detroit for some years now. I love the city, and I have to say, as an adopted Detroiter, although it makes me happy that maybe there's going to be some interest in Detroit, it makes me nervous also because the media has not treated Detroit well or even fairly in many cases. There's been a lot of the stereotypes we have about the city are because of reporters parachuting in, writing the stories that are based on stereotypes, and then parachuting back out to New York or D.C.
Well, I hope this isn't a parachute attack. This is a case of people moving in. And in my case, I grew up in Detroit. I lived there for the first 18 years of my life. I know the city extremely well. I think it's a very different circumstance. And the other thing that I think that we have to remember, even those of us who love Detroit, is that when the media, even the parachuters, come in and describe what they see on the ground that's horrible, it's because it's pretty horrible. And I think that you would have to say the same thing if you were driving through some of the devastated neighborhoods of that city.
We also have Judge Vonda Evans on the line. She's a sitting judge in the Third Circuit Court in Wayne County. Good morning, Your Honor. She joined us from Detroit. Do you agree it's pretty horrible in Detroit?
I believe that we are going through a change. And what we have seen is that there is an evolution. You know, the definition of extinction is an inability to adapt to your new surroundings. We are now challenged with that task, and I believe as Detroiters, being born and raised here, we're up to it. But we definitely have to change a lot of the things. And what we have to understand is that where we are today is not as a result of politicians making bad choices, but as a result of the big three defining the livelihood of what people were doing and their dependency on them. And now they've pulled out, so now we have to try to redefine ourselves by looking to other means of a tax base in order to pull us back up.
Very briefly, Judge Evans, one of the things that I find is often missing out of reports of Detroit and the tough situation there is a description of the people. Can you give me an idea of what makes the people there so strong and loyal to the city?
Well, it's what we are we're a block of what makes Americans strong. And that is that when faced with adversity, we're resilient, we're resourceful, and we will cling to one another to be able to build ourselves back up. And that's what I'm seeing. You're now seeing people in this city all gravitating to want to help one another.
Judge Vonda Evans is a sitting judge in the Third Circuit Court in Wayne County. Daniel Okrent, former editor and writer for Time, Inc.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. And coming up, coming out. That's right. Gay children are coming out at a younger age than ever before, and we'll find out what choices they're facing and actually live some of these moments in just a moment. After 4 months of gains, national home sales were down last month. We're asking you what you're seeing literally on your block, and Susan emails us, "I live on a less desirable street in a desirable community, Old Greenwich, Connecticut. Of the 22 houses on our street, 4 of them are for sale, more than I can ever remember seeing in the 30 years we've lived here. One that has been on the market more or less for 3 years finally sold last month at 50% of its original price."
Ouch.
That is hugely significant information. That is great. Keep it coming. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. But first, here are some of the news stories we're following at 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama says Iran is breaking the rules by running a secret uranium enrichment facility. The president joined British and French leaders last hour calling for Iran to come clean or face new sanctions. They want UN investigators to get inside the site. New numbers show that orders for big-ticket factory goods are down 2.4%. Markets were reacting earlier this morning, but the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up at this moment.
Staying with economic news, Fed boss Ben Bernanke said just this hour that a government program to spark business and consumer lending needs to keep going. The Fed is extending that program into next year. And we've got news just in from Afghanistan. Election officials now plan a recount of 10% of suspect ballot boxes. This is as 5 American troops are dead after separate attacks in the south. And a Denver man is in court today on charges he plotted to explode homemade bombs in the U.S. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is in stable condition at a hospital this morning. She became lightheaded yesterday after treatment for an iron deficiency. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
Well, as everyone knows, growing up is all about learning about some very sensitive subjects. Sexuality, what are you going to be when you grow up? Who are you going to be when you grow up? Your identity is very much bound up with your sexuality. And right now, we're going to talk about some very serious challenges for young people deciding whether to come out and admit that they are gay or disclose that they are gay at a very young age, maybe as young as 11, 12, or even 13. Joining us is Benoit Denizet-Lewis, contributing writer with the New York Times Magazine, author of America Anonymous, Eight Addicts in Search of a Life. But his piece in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, coming out in middle school, is really describing a trend which you found is quite unusual. Benoit, describe.
Yeah, I mean, historically, gay men have come out, used to be in college or later, and then it sort of moved down to high school. And now we're seeing kids coming out at 12, 13, 14, and it's throwing their families and their schools into a lot of disarray because we're sort of not ready for openly gay 12-year-olds.
It raises issues in the schools for teachers, for other kids, and you describe that in the article.
Yeah, in schools, it raises the question of, you know, anti-gay language, you're so gay, and words that are a lot worse than that, are thrown around regularly.
It's
sort of the insult
of
choice.
Yeah, in sixth grade, queers was a pejorative.
Yeah,
sixth grade, eons ago, back in the 1960s. Let me just ask you a personal question, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
When did you know you were gay?
I knew, and I read a little bit about this in the article, because there's sort of this question of, you know, how can a 12-year-old know? I'm 34 now.
Right.
I knew when I was 12, and I didn't accept it till I was 19.
When did you come out?
19.
So it's interesting. Now, Nick Weaver on the line from Tulsa, Oklahoma. How old are you?
I'm 15.
And you knew that you were gay in your own mind at what age?
12.
At 12. And when did you come out?
I came out at 12.
Wow, that represents a real change. Now,
Benoit,
you didn't come out because you were uncomfortable to do it at age 12 or 13 or 14 in high school. Why were you comfortable enough to come out in your high school?
Middle school.
It would have been middle school in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Nick.
I think it was just because at that day and age, you know, firstly, I had been raised to know that I am myself and I could accept myself. And I think, secondly, there was just so much more, you know, in the media, there was this promotion of it's okay to be you. It was independence was coming out. So for me, I just thought, this is who I am. It's not a big deal. I should share it with my family.
Yeah, he was very fortunate in having, you know, a mother who was incredibly supportive, and kids who have parents who are really what you want to be able to have a kid do is come to their parents and say, you know, because a lot of kids at 12 or 13 are just starting to realize they're confused about this. But, you know, for years, kids haven't had the opportunity to even say to their parents, you know, I'm attracted to this boy. I'm sort of attracted to girls. I don't know what I am. Now kids are starting to feel like they can have that conversation a little bit more with their parents.
Well, we've really got the generational shift here.
Yeah, about 20 years separate the two of you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Nick, who did you come out to?
Who did I come out to?
My mom.
So Nick came out to his mom. Who did you come out to, Benoit?
Who did I come out to? I came out to my parents pretty quickly.
But not first.
No, but what's interesting, the real difference here, one of the key differences is the internet. You know, I was just pre-internet in high school. Kids today can sort of – one of the girls I talked to in the story, she realized she liked both boys and girls when she was 10. Okay, so she said, all right, I'm going to think about this. I'm attracted to both. Where do I go from there? She went online to sort of look up bisexuality, and she said, actually, that sort of fits. I'm attracted to both. And she went she went to her mom, who was also supportive, very fortunate, and she said, I'm attracted to both. There's one of the interesting things that parents often do and that we often think about when a 12-year-old comes out is one of our first sort of gut reactions is, well, how do you know that? How do you know what you are? But it's interesting. We don't ask that question to a boy who comes to his mom and says, oh, I really like this girl, Jenny, or I'm really attracted to girls. We don't have that sort of initial reaction.
But to play the devil's advocate, I have an 11-year-old, and if my son says he has a crush on anybody, I don't take it seriously. You know, he doesn't understand those kind of issues the way that an older person does. So how does a 10-year-old understand these issues enough to know?
Well, let's pose that question, okay, to Nick Weaver's mom. Pam Anderson, are you there?
I am.
All right, so Pam, you know, this is sounding very utopian, this conversation here, but I'm wondering if your son comes out to you as supportive as you are, what are the alarm bells?
I guess
one of the alarm bells is just what Benoit was talking about in what he talks about in his article, which is my thought was, how does a 12-year-old know that he's gay? And in retrospect, looking back on it, and I kind of said as much to Nick when he first came out to me, not in those words, but he was upset whenever he was talking to me, and I didn't know if he was upset because he was afraid of my reaction or if he was upset because he thought he was gay and didn't want to be gay, which, of course, you know, I firmly believe is not a choice. It's who you are. And so I tried to reassure him by saying, well, Nick, you're only 12 years old. You're going through a lot right now. Let's just not make a huge deal out of this and you know, we'll revisit it and see how you feel, but don't, you know, just don't get too upset about it. Everything's okay. If you are gay, I love you no matter what, but don't be too upset. The other alarm bells, if you want to call them that, for me were just, I think, what every parent of a gay child worries about, which is what kind of ugliness and prejudice
right.
is he going
yeah.
to
Well, let's
to
put
confront.
That to Benoit for a moment. I mean, those concerns are absolutely stark real. What did you find in researching your article about the implications when people come out at this age in high schools and middle schools?
It's very this is a very nuanced thing. I mean, it really depends in parts of the country. Obviously, you know, if you grow up in a progressive city, it's less likely that you're going to hear the anti-gay language at school. But that's not a guarantee. The other thing that's really interesting that we have to talk about is that much of the harassment in middle school is much more about gender nonconformity than it is about sexual orientation. So a boy who is perceived as not acting masculine is going to get it a lot worse than a boy who comes out, matter-of-factly, who's seen as masculine and who comes out to his friends as gay.
Well, Nick Weaver, are you a fan of the Fox program Glee?
Yes.
So you're probably going to recognize this that happened this week on the program. Listen.
I don't want to lie anymore. Being a part of the Glee Club and football has really showed me that I can be anything. And what I am is I'm gay.
I know.
Really?
I've known since you were three. All you wanted for your birthday was a pair of sensible heels. I guess I'm not totally in love with the idea, but if that's who you are, there's nothing I can do about it. And I love you just as much. Thanks for telling me, Kurt. You sure, right?
Yeah, Dad. I'm sure.
I'm just checking.
So, Nick Weaver, people are all over the map on this subject, and there will be a debate about this conversation. But at the very least, we are in a moment of real social change, wouldn't you say?
Yes.
Benoit?
Absolutely. I mean, things are changing. 12-year-olds are coming out, and I think it's going to be up to sort of adults to change our thinking and say, okay, 12-year-olds are coming out. How do we make them safe?
Well, Benoit Denizet-Lewis, contributing writer with the New York Times Magazine, author of America Anonymous, Eight Addicts in Search of a Life. But you can read his piece on the subject we were just talking about this Sunday in the New York Times, Coming Out in Middle School. We also had 15-year-old Nick Weaver, who came out at 12 years old, to his mother, Pam Anderson. They both joined us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
If you want to weigh in on that story, maybe you have your own story of coming out, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email your story to mytake@thetakeaway.org. That's where you're telling us stories about your block to one of the housing changes on your street. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.